and welcome back to another great episode of Extra Features Interview. Today we have a fabulous director whose new film, Animal Among Us, is available to everybody to watch. So get out there and see it. But he will tell you at the end of the show where to find it. So you got to wait for that. John Woodruff is in the house. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thanks for the great introduction.
Well, I do try every once in a while. So you're an independent filmmaker. And I did a little bit of research before I saw the film. You have some good actors here, some lot of character actors I noticed. I recognize some of them, like, they look familiar, so I always do my research and look it up. So was that your plan, to go through some actresses and actors that people may recognize, may not recognize, or did you know the people?
So that's a pretty, it's an interesting question, and like with everything with production or trying to get a film to work, it's a bit of a process. So when we first started developing this film, we didn't really know what caliber of cast we would be able to get, and we didn't really know what budget level we were going to do the film at. And obviously, the budget affects the cast, you know. So as the script was getting stronger, we were kind of like shopping it around to different production companies, different potential financiers, and then also different actors. And Jonathan Murphy, the writer, he had some relationships with some actors from back when he was doing a lot of acting, and he'd been a really successful television actor, so he had some pretty good relationships. And these people started to respond very, very strongly to the script, so it started to indicate that we could get a little bit stronger of a cast, a little bit more known of a cast. So when we saw that, I kind of jumped onto the philosophy that Wes Craven used with Scream in 1996, of trying to expand your audience outside of just strictly the horror demographic by diversifying the cast with actors and actresses that you had seen in other things. So we just really got very, very fortunate with the response to the script, their willingness to come out and play with us, and then also, again, kind of calculating like, oh, wow, like this person has a tremendous amount of pull in this arena, and this person has a huge audience in that arena. And so consequently, we got kind of like this interesting cast that normally, you know, I don't think you would see together in a horror film.
You hit the nail right in the head is where I was going there. Like, it is such a diverse cast. We will get into characters in a little bit. I just want to discuss your location. I think we should work on that to set the tone for the movie. I mean, you kind of fool us at the beginning because I'm not really sure what's going on at the beginning of the film. You kind of just leave me there to figure it out, which is fine. And then you cut to, like, right, a studio location. Now, did you know the school? Like, that's a big, big place you have there.
Yeah. So basically, you know, we did this film under – it's our first feature film. And as you know, it's very difficult to make money in this industry unless you're in kind of like the top, like, percentile. You know, you're doing a studio film or a very high level independent film. So consequently, it's like we did have severe budget restrictions, which then bring about severe schedule restrictions, which in this case, and to the prior question, was kind of a blessing in disguise, because since we had to keep our schedule so tight, we were able to get a lot of these actors because they weren't signing on to something for 6 weeks or 2 months or 3 months. I mean, we had these people for 12 days. Oh, so wow. With that, yeah, I mean, we shot this fast, and we didn't even have money to go into overtime. So, I mean, we literally had 8 hours a day to shoot. So we did it very, very fast. And so I knew that I would need certain advantages to be able to get the production to work, to like make it through principal photography. And for me, one of those things was to take the film back to where I grew up, back to Ohio, to where I had a lot of contacts, a lot of relationships. I kind of knew the lay of the land. And as far as the scene that you're referencing with the college, the university, a lot of my crew went to film school there. And so I had a lot of connections to that university. So I started talking to people, and the university was excited that I was hiring their film students for a production, and they were very supportive of that. So they gave us a great, great deal on that lecture hall, and we were able to get in there for, oh man, we might have been in there for 2-3 hours to knock that scene out. And so again, it was just super fast, but that's how we were able to secure the lecture hall. Everything that's Roland's house, like the interiors of Roland's house and with he and his wife, that was all shot in Los Angeles. Oh, because Aaron Daniels, who played his wife, she's a mother, she has a family, she's super busy, and we weren't able to get her out to Ohio. So we actually decided, hey, we were based out of LA, we're like, we'll shoot everything out in Ohio, and then we'll come back, and it's just interiors of houses, so we'll shoot her out here. So again, it was another thing that ended up working well in the film, but was kind of dictated by budgetary restrictions. And then, of course, you know, the crown jewel of the film, the campground, also in southwestern Ohio, and a very versatile location as far as the different things this campground offered. It had like 500 acres that we could utilize. It's a company that, or a camp that hosts Fortune 500 companies, like kind of their corporate meetings and events and activities. So they had beautiful facilities for us to house the cast and crew in. And then it's an old camp. So off in like the further reaches of the camp, they had these places that were just perfect for what we needed as far as set pieces. So that's kind of – those were basically like the three major locations in the film. And that's kind of how that worked as far as getting those.
So now you let a little secret out when you told me you filmed the location. Because when you cut to Roland driving away, I never see him leaving the house. You cut immediately to a scene, him driving, and then you do a flashback to the note. So that was brilliant. I really liked the way you did that.
Well, thank you very much. And that is kind of one of the fun things with the magic of filmmaking and budgetary restrictions. Is it's like, okay, so the car we're using for Roland is in Ohio, but Roland's house and Roland's garage are in LA. So where can we double things and where can we shoot an interior of a garage and make it match, you know, like what you think you'd be seeing in a completely different state. So that was a really fun exercise for us.
So let's get into your characters a bit more. You have two major campers that run the camp. Yep. And you dress them, I want to discuss, very differently. Like, was that an intention to have one a little bit more conservative? But she's a little more aggressive than the other one. And the other one's look at me, come and look at me. Was that the plan?
Very intentional. Very, very intentional. Thank you for picking up on that. One of the things that we wanted to do with this film is we kind of wanted to take standard horror tropes that are necessary to quantify the film as a genre piece and to appeal to the audience. And we wanted to put a different spin on them. We wanted to kind of like turn them on their head as much as we could. So usually when you see a campground film, you're focusing on a group of kids that are going up there and they're partying or they're camping and they get shredded. So we wanted to find like these characters, and I think Jonathan Murphy did such a great job of this in the script, that were affiliated with this camp, that were bound to this camp in a stronger way than just like, oh, we're going up here to look for a legend or we're going up here to camp. I mean, it's like with Anita and Poppy, it's like they're bound to this camp through their family. With Burl, he's bound to them kind of through their life circumstance. Roland is bound to the camp through his book. So when you watch a scary movie, you're always like, why are you going into that room? Why are you going into that house? Why are you camping in this woods where murders happened? This kind of like held the nucleus together, we felt like, in a much stronger way. And so with that, then you start to like really look at like who these characters are. So for us, Anita was older. She was more aware of the family history. She was closer to their mom. She had a closer relationship with Burl just because of the fact that she was the older sister. In our minds, Poppy was a little bit younger. She was a little bit more naive. She was a little bit more in the dark as to like the history of this family and the history of this camp. And kind of when you're a little kid, you know, even up to maybe 8, 9, 10, your memories and your perceptions of things that happened are skewed, you know. Whereas if Anita was 16 or 17, she would probably have a pretty clear memory. So for us, that affected a lot then of how those two girls dressed, what their motives were, what their intentions were, and then also like very much their relationship with Burl, to where Anita has a lot of animosity towards Burl. There's a lot of tension there. There's implications that she's aware of something that happened that she's not happy with. And Poppy is a little bit more out there. Poppy's a little bit more playful and flirty and young and naive. And we also felt like it was one of those things where Anita has an agenda. She wants to get this camp up and running, and she has an agenda. Poppy, when you grow up in the middle of nowhere, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, all you can think about is escaping, like, you know, just grandiose like visions of the world. So we feel like she would have been a little bit more sexualized, a little bit more just, yeah, like playful and flirty and loose and out there, and also kind of excited to get attention from outside influences because of just her age and her life experience versus Anita's. And we felt like that created a lot of nice tension between those two sisters, naturally.
You keep using the word we. So is that you and the writer work flushing these characters out ahead of time, or is that with the actress you're flushing it out ahead of, with her?
I didn't hear the word.
You keep saying we. So I want to know if it's you and the writer working on the characters, or you and the actor working on the characters.
Yeah. Yeah, that would primarily be the writer, Jonathan Murphy, and myself.
Okay.
So we did work on the development of the script for a long time. He brought me a very early draft, and we started working on it, and we started shaping it and deciding, like, kind of where we wanted it to go and what we wanted it to be. And then as we were getting closer and as we were looking at casting, we were having a lot of conversations kind of about, like, the dynamic of these characters and the specificities of their relationships. And so that's why I guess I'm always – when I say we, I'm talking about Murphy and myself.
I presume so, but I think it's good to get it out there. So we know there's a collaboration happening. I think that's important. So he gets some insight here too, going, hey, I was talked about.
Yeah, no, for sure. And Murphy was also – we were the two lead producers on the film. So that's the other reason when I say we, I mean it was the two of us. Like, he wrote, I directed, we both produced, so we were – a very, like, unified front in making this thing happen.
So where does the name Merrymakers Camp come from, established in 1994?
That comes from Jonathan Murphy's brain. And he's very good at coming up with these things, I feel like, that are unique enough to be memorable, but they still have a nostalgia and a familiar air to them. So he's so well... Just so well read, and he's so well, he's so knowledgeable about films, you know, that it's interesting because while they do, I think, shape and influence his imagination and his stories and his vision, he is still able to hold on to, like, some very unique ideas. And I think, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, he knew we need a name like a Crystal Lake or an Elm Street, or we need something that will resonate with audiences that's easily memorable that people can, like, just dredge up. And Merrymaker seemed like it. It's also, given the story, horribly ironic, which I absolutely love, you know. So, yeah, I give that one to Murph. And to that point, when we were designing the film, we were very much thinking about how do you set the stage for a potential horror icon? You know, it's like you have to have, like, the origin story. You have to have the weapon. You have to have the location. You have to have the costume piece. You have to have, like, these certain things to create a horror icon. And so, much like in Friday the 13th, where you barely see Jason Voorhees, we kind of wanted to start to set the stage for a potential horror icon.
Okay, well, I was going there soon, so let's just go there. You do have a creature, but I also want to discuss one character. We can go back to her, the creature. We'll discuss them at the same time. The first time we see the creature, we kind of see the Spanish lady at the same time.
Yep.
Now, I kind of feel, maybe as a viewer, robbed. I don't really have a lot of background for the Spanish lady, other than I think she's hunting this creature down. Did she have more story, or she's just there for what she is?
She's just there for what she is. Okay. And we kind of wanted to start the film by dropping people into this campground. We wanted to disorient them a little bit. But obviously you don't want to confuse people. So that's a tricky balance to maintain. It's like mystery is good, confusion is bad. So even from the opening shot, it was planned to kind of, like, drop you into this situation with her to where she's obviously a little bit in over her head. She's a little bit disoriented and doesn't really know exactly what's happening or where she's at. She understands she's in a woods. She understands she's in a campground. She understands something bad could be happening to her. And so we wanted to put the audience, like, right there with her. So we felt that, like, that was kind of like a good introduction to Merrymaker. We also wanted to hook people really hard and really fast with the whole creature feature thing. So that's kind of like how we set the stage for the film in that opening scene. But as far as for her character, we did want to have, like, it was very intentional to have, like, a limited perception and perspective of her because she's an outsider. She's a trespasser. She's an unknown. And Poppy and Anita are kind of dealing with that. And that's something that they've dealt with a lot in running the Merrymaker campgrounds. And then also, you know, it's like there was a bit of social commentary in there about her language barrier, them kind of like constantly like discrediting her, pushing her to the side, her not being heard. So that was like a very intentional thing too, to where we felt like we could weave a little bit of socio-political commentary in there without like beating people over the head of it, and have some fun with the fact that like this girl has a huge language barrier and she's hypothetically the one person that could just sit down and tell you this is exactly what happened, but she can't do it because she speaks a different language. And we thought that that was very kind of like ironic, because a lot of times I watch films and I'm like, this whole thing could be resolved right now if this character would just have a conversation with this character. Like, it would be over. So with the character of Lupita and what she saw and what she experienced, if she could talk, you know, the jig is up. So she has this language barrier, and it kind of becomes this really fun game of like, oh, we know she saw something. What did she see? Yeah. But she's incapable of explaining it to us in a way we understand.
So let's discuss your creature. The look of the creature is really why I want to discuss. I mean, that couldn't have been an easy job, or – I mean, I don't know. I think it's hot when you're shooting. It looks warm because they're all wearing shorts and T-shirts. And is he wearing a costume, or is that all makeup? Because, I mean, I can't really get a good shot of it because you never give me a full creature shot. You do for 2 seconds, like when he runs by something. I said, but I can't really focus.
Yeah. No, you definitely can't. And that's definitely very intentional as well, because, again, like going back to budget restrictions and audience expectations in this day and age, you know, my thought was just like, look, we're not going to be able to deliver a creature that's fully satisfying if we have to show it in like a locked down medium close up or something, you know? So it's like, how do we like give the audience something that's satisfying? How do we do the story justice? And how do we maintain like a degree of practicality? Because again, it, to your point, it was relatively warm when we were shooting and we had to shoot fast. So I couldn't have a guy in hair and makeup and costume for 4 hours prepping for this. So basically, you know, and since you've seen the movie, you'll kind of understand this a little bit. We tried to keep the costume as grounded in reality as we possibly could. We tried to keep the costume as functional as we possibly could, just so that it could make sense, like, for the viewer watching the film, but also in the world that was Merrymaker. So in kind of, like, taking that approach, it did affect, like, the application and removal of the costume for shooting purposes. And it also did affect the way that we shot the film. And our idea was, you know, basically it's like people obviously always have ideas that like, oh, something could be in the woods or the paranormal or, you know, is there a Loch Ness monster or is there not? Like there are these certain like creatures, and Bigfoot's probably the most infamous, that kind of are on the fringe of reality a little bit like a lot closer than like a werewolf or a vampire. So our thought process with this was we really need to capture the mystery. We need to capture the intrigue, and we need to like set it up so that the characters in this film and the audience might believe that this is still within the peripheral bounds of reality. It's not like, oh, is it a werewolf? Like, well, we know werewolves probably aren't real. So we tried to kind of like reduce the distance between the fantastical and reality by positioning this creature where we did. And again, then it commonly comes down to, it's like, well, it's some kind of creature, something's out there. It obviously must be a Bigfoot. Like, what else would it be? You know? So that was kind of our approach.
Hey, it works. You use a lot of props in your film. You have a bear trap prop.
Yeah.
At one point you have a lot of gun props.
Yeah.
And I wanted to really get into the mask.
Because
the mask comes and goes. It's around a few times, that mask. Now, was that your plan to sort of slip mask propaganda in? We have it at the beginning, we have it in the middle, and we definitely have it at the end. Well, right before the end.
Yeah.
Was I supposed to pick up on all that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, so everything that you just picked up on, from the animal traps and the guns, you know, kind of insinuating like a hunt.
Yes.
Kind of suggesting the pursuit of a beast or an animal, and then the masks coming on and off. And I'm sure, as you noticed, Roland's mask is a wolf mask. So this was obviously like a very literal, very figurative metaphor to kind of explore, like in the horror genre, we always, especially in slasher films, we always have like the masked stranger, you know, or the shape or the shadow or the unknown that's like killing people. And masks are so prominent in horror films, but they've never really been explored on screen within the bounds of the story in a more literal way. So we definitely wanted to explore those themes. And with that then comes the idea that in life, you know, all the world is a stage and we are but players on that stage. And we're constantly like putting masks on and taking masks off depending on the circumstance and the situation we find ourselves in. We act different with certain groups of friends than we do with family, and we act different in front of strangers or at the workplace than we do at home. So the mask was very much a way to kind of like bind these people to the idea of this hunt and things like the trap and the guns and the campground and the pursuit and unraveling the mystery. And it was also to kind of like indicate like a little bit like back to the title, The Animal Among Us, and animalistic qualities and tendencies, and the fact that when you're talking to somebody, you never quite know what you're looking at, who you're looking at, and what they really are. So definitely for me, the masks were a central theme throughout the film, and a very important piece of the story.
I did leave out one thing I wanted to discuss. Who had to write that letter that we see? We actually see an actual handwritten letter at one point in the film.
Pretty sure that Jonathan Murphy wrote that. I'm pretty sure that he scrawled that handwritten letter out, because, and it was actually an idea of Christian Oliver, who played Roland. He really wanted to read that. He goes, I just think that, he goes, if I memorize it and I act it out, you know, he goes, I'm acting like I'm reading it. If I'm reading it, I'm reading it, you know. And obviously Christian's a phenomenal actor. He had a tremendous amount of lines to remember. We had a very tight schedule. So that was a big block, a chunk with a lot of details that then he didn't have to remember. And also, you know, again, like I think that it did give him something to work with as far as like he's actually reading it and making these discoveries, so that it elicits these reactions and can really like have some fun with it and pull you in, you know.
We did forget to discuss one location, at least I did. I want to discuss that crazy bookstore. Where did you find that? I have it in my notes, and I forgot to write it up higher. Where did that bookstore come from?
Believe it or not, like happy just fate or chance, happenstance, if you will, it was right across the street from the campground. So, you know, we just sent some people over and asked, it's like, hey, would you guys mind, you know, if we shot this one scene in there? And they were like, yeah, that would be great. And we didn't – that was one of the few locations that we had to do nothing to, like, decorate or enhance at all. It just – the way it was perfect.
That bookstore is nuts. I so want to visit that place.
It's amazing. It's a really neat place.
Another thing you may have just stumbled across, when you're in the campgrounds, I mean, you have the main part you're in all the time, but you see a ruins in the video Lapita has. Did you stumble upon those ruins while you were there, or you knew they were there?
Well, so when we were scouting locations, you know, we were going to these different campgrounds, and it was really interesting because we would find campgrounds that were like very, very minimalist and utilitarian and primitive, and we knew we needed something that was more developed than that. But then in this day and age, a lot of these campgrounds are really modern and they're really fancy. So it was tricky to find a campground that like was that balance of what we needed to be able to make the story believable. And so when we found this campground, again, it was a huge area and we were kind of free to roam. So we were just walking around. We were going to like the different places where there's something to see. And as we were making these discoveries, we kind of like started to make little adjustments to the script where it's like, well, instead of, you know, them going up to this cave, they're going to go to this like dilapidated, beat down old cabin with a bunker. And, you know, instead of going over here to like the cemetery, they're going to go out here to these like ruins, you know? And so we kind of, and I think like, you know, on a smaller film with limited time and money, I always say like big films, studio films, they have the money and the power to fight the light. Meaning if they want to blot out the sun, they blot out the sun. And if they want to light up the night, they light up the night. The little guys, we can't do that. So we have to try to find clever, cunning ways to make it work. And part of that is kind of being able to adjust the script enough that it doesn't like affect or interfere with the story, but it works within the confines of the story. And in a lot of instances for me, I actually think it enhances it. I think you get more unique qualities and more interesting elements. I mean, we would have never thought about like the dilapidated old cabin and the kind of bunker aspect. We were totally just thinking cave. And while I think either works, I think that in all actuality, the dilapidated cabin and the bunker is more effective thematically in this story than a cave would have been.
Fair enough. I agree with you. Now, you keep bringing up lighting and blocking. How is night shooting? Because a lot of this takes place at night.
Yeah, it does. And that was one of the major challenges with this film. A big pet peeve of mine when I'm watching indie horror or any film, actually even studio films, is when there's unjustified light sources. You know, I grew up in the middle of nowhere. It's like I spend a lot of time outside. You find yourself outside at night all the time. And, you know, the moon, if it's full, like, you'll get a decent amount of light off of it. But a lot of these films, like, they just blow the woods up. Like, it's so bright. So for me, it was all about, like, on these night shoots, keeping characters close to justifiable light sources. So that's where you see, like, the lights on top of the Merrymaker sign. It's like, they're in the middle of the woods. They're in the middle of nowhere. Like, we have to have a justifiable light source, and we can't believe that everything is the full moon, you know? Same with them when they're walking and they have flashlights, or they're walking and they're close to the exterior of a building and porch lights and interior lights are on and lights in the background. I really tried to, like, account for that and plan for that so that when we were in these outside, like, nighttime locations – or interiors at night, whatever it is, that we just had justified light sources. Also, the fact, again, that we didn't have a tremendous amount of money, we kind of, like, by necessity needed to stay closer to places just to keep it, like, more practical and more affordable. Again, though, had I all the money in the world, I still would have set these pieces where they were set, these scenes near these, like, locations, just so that the light sources were actually, like, justified and made some kind of sense, you know?
Well, I don't want to leave out Burrow at all because we haven't discussed him at all. Where did you find him? He looks like a real guy that would live in the woods. If you told me,
he is a real guy. He is a real guy that would live in the woods. Actually, he lives in the desert. Okay. He's from Arizona. But Don Fry and I go way back. I've been friends with him for years. We worked on a film in the early 2000s. That's where we met when I was still acting. And we became really good friends. He is in the UFC Hall of Fame, two-time UFC heavyweight champion of the world, still holds some records as far as, like, quickest knockout. And back when he first started fighting, they would fight in bracket style. So he would fight, you know, four, five, six fights in one night to win the championship. And it's also back – this is, like, late 90s when it was really controversial because it was truly no-holds-barred fighting. So headbutts, knees to the face, elbows to the face, they did not – it was really no holds barred fighting, and they would let these guys go. They didn't, like, call the fights short, you know, on like a TKO or something like that, or when somebody's defenseless like they do in this day and age. So there also was, like, no weight divisions. So Don Fry would weigh in, you know, maybe like 215, 220 – and he was fighting these guys that would be like close to, you know, 280, 300 pounds, sometimes bigger. So the guy is a legend. He's in the UFC Hall of Fame. He's won K1. He's won Pride. A lot of people consider him to be like the toughest man alive or the toughest man that ever lived. And it's like, I'll completely attest to that. He's an absolute animal, for lack of a better term, but he's also one of the absolute just sweetest people you could ever meet. And one of my absolute best friends. So we go way back, and as we were getting closer to shooting this, it was obvious that he would just be a perfect fit, that no one else could do it. We felt like Burl had the potential to be on a much smaller scale, a character reminiscent a bit of Quint in Jaws. And, you know, obviously, like, when they went and cast Quint, they didn't go necessarily to the pool of Hollywood actors that were always working. They cast a little bit outside of that, and he's one of the most profound and memorable characters in film history. So on a tiny, tiny scale, we wanted to try to accomplish that a little bit with Burl. And I feel like, you know, his authenticity and his realism as a real life tough guy, like, carries over to that character and through the camera. And the thing with him is just constantly telling him, like, look, everybody's already afraid of you. So just, like, calm it down, buddy. Talk to her like you talk to your daughter. Talk to him like you talk to your horse. Like you don't have to be tough at all because you're just already a monster. So he's phenomenal guy.
That's funny. I'm glad I asked. I almost forgot. That was never good. You don't use a lot of music, but you do a little bit of music. Was that a point not to overflow music? Because I find you really let the character set the tone in your film as opposed to music.
Yeah, you know, I think the trick is with anything in a film is not letting one thing really get in the way of the other. Hopefully, you know, you're trying to bring it all together cohesively. We actually had three different composers on this film. I started with Michael Plaster. He does a lot of like kind of organic music and kind of more orchestral pieces, more of traditional scores. But I knew that we needed something that was a little bit more synth-based, a little bit more derivative of the 80s, kind of like horror films. So we brought in a guy named Alexander Taylor, who is kind of more well-versed in that, or stylistically leans a little bit more in that direction. So we started to like build this kind of like try to build this cohesive score between a little bit more of electronic and synth with 80s influence and then a classical score. And in order to do that, we needed a bridge. So that's where then we got Guy Couturier, and he was a founding member of Earshot, a brilliant songwriter, brilliant guitarist and bass player. And so he was the guy that was laying down those really heavy like guitar licks for us, and kind of like what, you know, almost like the heavy like modern electronic that kind of like holds those first two styles together. And overall, I'm very happy with it because I do think that it's a bit like understated and very cohesive. I don't think it like reaches out and like grabs you by the throat, but I don't think that it should. I think it needs to be balanced with everything else that's happening in the film. And I think that, you know, I'm very happy with what we ended up accomplishing with the score.
So you're out in the middle of nowhere, which we've established for this campground. I don't know how far you are. How do you feed these people? I mean, I know you have catering of some kind, but you're not like near a subway.
Right. So one of the things that we were looking for in doing this, and again, because of the limited budgets and the necessity to stay practical in the production of this, was a campground that could facilitate our needs on camera and off camera. So the fact that this campground hosts Fortune 500 companies, again, like means that they kind of have like places to stay that are up to standards, actually nicer than a lot of hotels. So we were able to negotiate it with the camp that we slept everybody there. And they, since they have an industrial kitchen, they were willing to feed us twice a day. So that meant that the production only had to come up with one meal a day. So basically, like whatever our two heaviest meals were, I mean, if we were doing a day shoot, it's like, depending on what when our call was, we might do breakfast, and we have the camp do breakfast and lunch, and then the production would do dinner because everybody would be wrapped out by then, or we might have them do lunch and dinner and we would do breakfast. It just really depended on the time of day and the two heaviest meals, because they were just better equipped to deal with it than we were on an industrial level, and they were so easy to work with, and they were just so accommodating, and the food was really good, and it was a lot of fun.
One last thing, and this is my one – I have a couple of things I want to discuss. I would have liked a little bit more information of the background on Merrymakers. I know you tried to exposition it for me. I appreciate that. I know you're having a limited budget. Did you ever think there should have been a bit more? And I know you couldn't have showed me because you didn't have time either. And I understand that could have been a constraint.
You know, it's interesting. I think with like all art, be it filmmaking or writing or painting or directing or anything, like obviously like it's a process and there's a learning curve. And the thing that's interesting with filmmaking is they talk about the fact that there's no handicaps in filmmaking. You know, it's like when it's out there for the world to see, it's like everybody's looking at it through this extremely limited perspective of a screen, and they don't know what you had to work with, and they don't know what you didn't have to work with, and they don't know if most people, the common viewer, doesn't really know if it's your first film or if it's your 20th film, and if you had studio backing or if you're truly an independent. And so it's one of those things where it's like, to be completely honest, like we're young as filmmakers. I mean, this is our first feature film. It's the first feature film that Jonathan's written. It's the first feature film that I've directed, first feature film that either one of us has produced. And there are a lot of moving pieces, and there's a lot of things to learn as you're going through that. So kind of what we did in the development of the script was he brought me a script. There were a lot of great ideas in there, and there were a lot of great pieces in place. And I started giving him feedback on that script to try to strengthen it, because at some point, everybody needs feedback on their material. Even Stephen King has, you know, an editor and a wife read his material. So we started kind of doing that. And then when we would get it to where we felt like it was strong enough, we would hand it off to people that we felt like were more experienced than we were. So we had the fortune of handing it off to an ex-studio head that I worked for, who's made some absolutely prolific films. And we also had the fortune of handing off to some independent filmmakers who teach screenwriting on a doctoral level and who are a master's level, sorry, and who are also just very well versed in cinema and screenwriting. And so kind of between those, you know, we just shaped it and got it as close as we possibly could. And there comes a point where then your cast is locked and your location's locked and the money's locked and you're either shooting before the weather goes bad or you're waiting another year. So you just kind of get out there and make it happen. With that being said, obviously we wanted to try to do something a little bit different. We wanted to try to do something a little bit unique. So there were challenges in and of that. And a lot of the decisions that were made were kind of made because it's like, well, how do we set this up? How do we lead people down this path to start to think the film is going in another direction and then take that severe left turn to kind of keep them off balance and take it in different directions? Like, obviously, the film is very kind of much a mystery and there's a lot of elements of conspiracy in it. And in order for mystery and conspiracy to work, you have to plant the seeds of mystery and conspiracy. So some of the lack of information we felt like was necessary, and the way in which that information is delved out, we felt like it was necessary to kind of like trail people along with breadcrumbs. And some of it was due to just time restrictions and where we were at as filmmakers, you know. At the end of the day, Jonathan is like this and I'm like this too. You learn so fast that by the time you're shooting even, you know, you're already wishing that you would have done things differently in development. And then by the time you're in post, you're already wishing you would have done things different while you're shooting. And then by the time you're done with post, you go through a period where you hate the entire film and you wish you would have done everything different. And then you kind of like come back down to earth and you're like, okay, like, We hung in there, we got it done, and then it kind of starts to grow on you a little bit again. And it's just, it's a huge mind twist, and it's a huge kind of like emotional and mental roller coaster, just ups and downs. For me, I'm always mad at every point in the process because I'm always looking back at, you know, the previous part of the process, just like, oh, I would have done that different, or I would have switched that. Because again, like, your perspective widens and you've learned more. But you just have to like keep going and be like, hey, you know, it's like, next time I know, next time I want to do it different, next time I want to do it like this. And I think that's so much of the art of filmmaking and one of the things that just makes it so challenging and so magical and so fun, you know?
Well, that covered my next question too. So I'm going to skip asking about the ending because that covers it. I don't need to ask that one. So let's move on to the final part of the show, which is fun questions. So what's your favorite film?
Favorite film? It varies from day to day. I mean, it depends on my mood. It depends on what I'm doing. It depends on so many things, but things that immediately come to mind, I throw out Scream a lot.
Jaws.
I throw out Jaws a lot. And then I throw out There Will Be Blood a lot if we're not staying genre specific.
No, whatever you want.
Yeah. So those would probably be pretty far up there, but Jaws and Scream are probably safely top two favorite films. Probably
the last film you saw in the theater, non-independent.
Oh, the last film that I saw in a theater was Dr. Sleep.
Okay. And now,
I go pretty often. I go to the cinema a lot. I live in Los Angeles, very accessible. A lot of unique screenings out here, films that they do re-releases on or just limited one-night exhibitions, lots of Q&As, and obviously the films out here hit first. I mean, like, for everybody else, it's on Friday or Thursday, and for us, a lot of times we can go Wednesday at midnight and see them. So I go to the cinema a lot.
That's awesome. Now, the one film you should have seen and never have.
There's probably a lot more than one. I probably shouldn't even admit this publicly, but honestly, as I think about it, I've never seen Citizen Kane.
Wow.
I've never watched Citizen Kane. Yeah.
I
watch a lot of old Western, Sergio Leone films, the spaghetti Westerns. I love, you know, classic horror and classic cinema, the old Hitchcock stuff. I love, you know, stuff like Invasion of the Body Snatchers, old Roman Polanski films. Like, just, I do love like old films, but for some reason, I know I should see it. I'm never like, this is the day, you know? So it just hasn't happened. That's the one that I definitely should have seen, arguably the most influential film in the history of man. And yeah, I haven't seen it.
Animal Among Us is available where?
It's available on Amazon, Vudu, Fandango, Google Play, Xbox, DirecTV, Dish, Walmart, Target, Family Video.
You can buy it?
And yeah.
On a DVD.
We got DVDs in you can do pre-orders through Walmart and pre-orders through Target, and I have heard that it should be on shelves, at least in Walmart, and it's already on shelves in Family Video, and you can also get hard copies off of Amazon, and then all of those other ones, of course, are also on iTunes and Apple TV, and you can dial it up and you can order it or you can rent it, so we were very fortunate. We got a very wide release, and that's much in credit to our wonderful distributor, Uncorked. A lot of first-time filmmakers have a really wretched experience with distribution. We've had a dream of an experience. Uncorked has been amazing. They've got us on all of those platforms and more. I'm sure there are a few that I'm forgetting. And then they hooked us up with an amazing publicist, Clint Morris, over at October Coast. He has done such a great job at getting this film out and the word out, and it's gotten so much larger of a response than I ever expected for a tiny first-time feature, and so it's been a pretty wild ride. And yeah, you can find it. If you Google it, I'm proud to say it pops right up.
That's awesome. Thank you for your time. Have a great day.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, I just want to say thank you for listening to this great interview. We have more on our website at www.extrafeatures.ca. And if you enjoyed it, can you please go to iTunes and leave us an iTunes review and like us on our Facebook page? Thank you.